Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Sixth Division, the Honorable Justice Sharon O. Johnson presiding. Case number 21-1304, People versus William Gardner.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for your patience. I'm Justice Sharon O. Johnson, presiding judge of the Sixth Division. I am joined by my colleagues, Justice Michael B. Hyman and Justice Carl A. Walker. For the record, we are also joined and being observed by students from the Appellate Clinic at the DePaul University School of Law, as well as students from the Texas Southern School of Law. Will the appellant's attorney please state your appearance for the record?
Yes, this is Jonathan Yeasting of the Office of the State Appellate Defender. I'm substituting in for Brian Rain of my office, who was on the briefs.
Okay, very well. And will the appellee's counsel please state your appearance for the record?
Assistant State's Attorney Amy McGowan for the people.
Okay, you will each be granted 20 minutes in which to present your argument today, with the appellant being given the opportunity to reserve time for rebuttal. Attorney Yeasting, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to reserve about 2 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, very well. You may begin.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. In this shooting case, the evidence pointed to a suspect who we know possessed the murder weapon, who admitted committing a shooting in the vicinity of the shooting that day, and who was stopped by a detective.
What do you mean by the vicinity?
Yes, this is, of course, in terms of vicinity. We know that the gun that Mr. Levante Bell said he used is found in the alley that day. It's the Glock 22.
Wait, but Bell didn't say he, it was Cooper, I thought, who said that Bell called him and said he had shot at a liquor store at Kedzie and Franklin. Is that correct?
That's right. It's about 4 to 5 blocks north of the scene. I'd suggest that Mr. Bell is trying to set up an exculpatory account of why he's involved in this shooting, because we know that that Glock 22 that Levante Bell was given is the gun that is recovered just a block within a block of the scene of the shooting in this case, and ballistics links it to the Vizel and Winter shooting. So he's calling his uncle in a panic, asking if this Glock 22, the specific gun that is the murder weapon, is registered and could be traced back, and the uncle says it can. He calls again in a panic and tries to come up with this story as to how he was involved in a different shooting purportedly 4 to 5 blocks away.
And he's been worried that it is, the evidence shows that he and Gardner were at least friends, because that's what he wrote when he visited him 4 times in prison. Correct?
There is no evidence of any contact between Bell and Gardner before the shooting. And it's crucial here.
That. I said afterwards they were friends. He and Bell knew one another. That's the important point. Whether there was contact beforehand is not important. What is important is that they knew each other. And so there is a connection between the gun in Bell's hands and the gun in Gardner's hands. And that is that Bell might have been nervous knowing that a shooting had transpired with Gardner having the gun. I mean, isn't that a reasonable conclusion on the facts that the jury could have come to?
I would submit that it's speculation on these facts, especially where the state offers no accountability theory because they're trying to get a firearm enhancement on my client only. They never put Levante Bell's photo before any of their witnesses. And recall that Levante Bell is stopped on this block at where the alley exits to Lake Street by Detective Rodriguez right in the wake of the shooting, with a description that matches what was given of the offender.
Oh, wait, let's talk about that. What is her description?
The best that the Detective Rodriguez can recall is that it's a black male, average height, wearing dark clothing.
Okay, that's correct. Now, what was the description by Shavers and the three officers of the suspect?
Well, the initial description is what Detective Rodriguez receives. This very generic description.
No, I didn't say that. I said, what is there? And the record has their description. I mean, I can say it if you want, but I'm asking you, what description did they give at the trial?
They give at the trial. Once they have a Gardner, and you know, once they find a do-rag, we're adding in these additional facts.
What was the color of the pants?
They say a dark t-shirt, blue or bright blue pants, depending on the witness, and they add in a do-rag gets added in after they recover the do-rag.
But the light blue pants comes up, and we can see in the video, it's not the greatest video, but we can see pants are light. So, and Rodriguez described dark pants. So that is something the jury could take account of. There's that. The police officers say they're chasing someone with light blue pants. Rodriguez never mentioned that. And the lawyer could have asked Rodriguez about that at the trial. Never did he?
I believe the description that she offers is that it's dark clothing. We don't get anything any more specific.
And what I'm saying is the defense lawyer could have come out to say, you know, could he or she, the defense lawyer would know what color the description was by the officers. So,
well, one thing that comes up in this case a lot is we have these incredibly generic descriptions, especially early on, coming from the officers. And I think Officer Stritzel's fairly remarkable testimony suggests why. He actually admits that when there's a police-involved shooting, you know, these officers fired off 8 rounds into the Garfield Park neighborhood, you don't write anything down in the wake of the shooting. That is a striking admission to me to actually see in a record.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Approximately how many people were out in this, within that block during the shooting?
The video shows about 6 to 8 people, and I can't recall specifically. There's the group of men with one other person by them who seem to be involved in a dice game and hanging around, and there's a few people in the foreground. And one thing I note about the video is the video is somewhat distorted in shape, and the color is remarkable, that if you watch the shooter, the color of the shooter's pants, which was just brought up, at points it looks to be a bright blue, but as the shooter steps to the right, because the saturation of the video is off, the shooter's pants suddenly appear to be gray or as if faded blue jeans. And it makes me wonder if this bright blue description is something that came in later on after somebody saw the distorted color from the video.
Was there any testimony or evidence with respect to what any of the other people who were present were wearing? Was anyone else wearing any bright blue pants?
I believe there's one person that, like the shooter, seems to be wearing perhaps blue jeans that you can see. But the only eyewitness we have to the shooting itself is Mr. Sharon Winters, and he says my client didn't do it. He says it was my client's 5'6". He says it was somebody significantly taller than my client. And that is the only actual eyewitness testimony we have to the shooting.
So let me just jump in for a second, Mr. Easton. I've been trying to jump in, but I'm so polite that I kind of usually want to let you finish saying what you have to say before I jump in. But you began to speak about the second phone call that Mr. Bell made, and then just Simon interrupted you, and you didn't finish telling us about that. Tell us more about that second phone call to his uncle.
Well, the crucial thing of the second phone call is, and this is still within about an hour of the shooting, he calls his uncle back. He's figured out that this Glock 22 is traceable to the uncle and perhaps to him. He calls the uncle back and says that he was involved in a shooting. And he puts the location in that call a few blocks away, like three or four, I think it's 4 or 5 blocks north of this scene on Maypole Lake area, and tells the uncle that he was shot at by somebody, he fired shots back, and then he ran from, I believe he's saying, I ran from police officers, just as the three officers' testimony is that my client purportedly did.
And so is there any evidence that the gun that was later recovered was the gun that was owned by this uncle? Because I believe the gun was owned by the uncle, correct?
Yeah, it is registered to the uncle. He actually acknowledges, and I believe he pleads to a probation case for transferring the gun to Levante Bell. the uncle initially reports is stolen, then admits he gave it to Levante Bell. That gun, that Glock 22, is the one that is ballistically linked to the shooting, and it's recovered along the path that Levante Bell, that Detective Rodriguez stopped Levante Bell when he was running from that scene.
So based on what we have here, then possibly we have two guns. The gun that Levante was some miles away, where he fired that gun, firing back at people who fired at him, and then the gun that was allegedly recovered at the scene. Correct. I mean, that would be Levante Bell's argument that there are two guns. There's that gun, and there's the gun that I had when I was over here, and so forth. Is that correct?
That is a possibility. I would submit it's much more likely, because Levante is specifically concerned about this one Glock 22 that is the murder weapon, and he's saying, I threw it in a yard in this area. Maybe he's a couple blocks off, but unless there's multiple guns that Levante Bell threw in that area while he was running from the police, then it's Levante Bell's, the gun that Levante Bell is saying he had that day.
Okay, and I asked you, was that correct? That probably wasn't the right way for me to ask you that. I think that's what everybody was led to believe is what I should have said, rather than is it correct? And you've answered the question. So let me ask you this, though. So given our standard of review here, we're reviewing court, and we must consider the evidence in the light most favorable to the state at this point. And our question is whether or not any reasonable jury could have found him guilty of these charges based upon the evidence. Give us the other evidence that you have. You just told me something interesting, which I did know that was in the record, but I want to ask you more about it. Tell us what else you have that we can now look at this evidence in a light most favorable to the state and still take the position that the evidence is not sufficient.
Sharon Winters, Your Honor. Sharon Winters is the victim of the aggravated battery in this case. He is the only person who's at that dice game in that shooting scene to testify. And he says, it's not my client, it's somebody that's taller than my client. And the fact that the only actual eyewitness, not somebody speculating as to some blurry pixels on a very poor video show, but the only actual eyewitness says it's not my client, is compelling. And that, plus Levante Bell, brings this case out of all those standard identification cases. A lot of the briefing in this case gets bogged down in all those biggest factors, when there's two big facts that distinguish all those cases, which is there's an eyewitness who's right there and says that my client's not the guy, and there's Levante Bell, who we know had that murder weapon and was stopped fleeing the scene of that shooting.
And we also know that Mr. Winters was extremely uncooperative after the shooting. Isn't that correct?
I believe there's a detective's accusation that he didn't feel that Mr. Winters was a cooperative.
He wasn't cooperative, was he? That's what his testimony was. He was not cooperative, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Did he testify at trial?
Yes, Mr. Winters testified at trial. He was called by the defense. He directly said that my client was not the shooter, that the shooter was somebody taller and larger. My client's about 5'6".
Basically, Mr. Easting, then you're telling us that Mr. Winters said, this is not the person who shot me.
That is what he testified to at trial. Okay. He didn't
make it. Can you address your client's clothing or clothing with your client's DNA being present near the chase?
So the state recovers what's described as a nylon that appears to, it variously gets described as a nylon, a wave cap or a do-rag, and a white tank top that's intermeshed with a black t-shirt near the scene. My client's is one of multiple profiles, and it's on each of those items. Now, the remarkable thing to me is the state never tests the reported black t-shirt that's recovered there. There's never a GSR test done on this t-shirt, even though it's purportedly what the shooter was wearing only a few hours at most before. And then as to some of the other things, this question of there's the do-rag or wave cap, but the witness testimony is all over the place as to whether whoever the shooter was and whoever the officers saw fleeing was actually wearing a do-rag or wave cap. It's only after this thing is recovered and after there's a DNA linkage that we start to see this come in the witness's testimony.
Well, let's go back. I find it interesting that your reply brief, what in the reply brief did you talk, not you, but did the defense discuss the DNA at all? Is it even mentioned in the reply brief?
I don't recall if it's mentioned in the
reply. I don't believe it's mentioned in the reply. But let me ask my question. It's not responded to. And you just gave a response to Justice Johnson's question in which you're not talking about the DNA specifically, but the DNA, which apparently you're not contesting, is a match to Gardner. And in the general population, it's one in 530 quintillion, which is, according to the testimony, 1.8 trillion times more unlikely to be found than in to win the Powerball lottery. I mean, it's his DNA is what it is.
Yeah, I'm not disputing that my client's DNA is one of those profiles. There's multiple profiles on those.
They found your client's profile. Would you agree to that?
Yes.
Okay, that's the question. So the T-shirt, the white T-shirt, belonged to your client, and he took it off and also took off, apparently, a black shirt because they were twisted together. Now, when we just look at that, definitely he's there. Definitely he took off clothes. Mr. Bell had on clothes. But this person took off clothes and escaped. And it's all happening in the same vicinity, and the gun, he's running around those lots in the alley as well. Everybody's around there. So why, going back to Justice Walker, has the key question that we have to consider. Taking the evidence in favor of the prosecution as we must, why couldn't the jury come out with this decision?
Your Honor, because of Levante Bell, I think is crucial here.
Well, but Levante Bell, you know, that doesn't mean that they didn't take account of what the testimony was. It was given. A victim, one of the victims testified, the one who lived. And so, you know, the jury didn't believe him. That's okay.
Your Honor, I would submit that in every case where this court has reversed for insufficiency of the evidence, it was facts that were before the jury or at least the trier of fact. The question is whether they could draw reasonable inferences to get to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And given that almost completely uncontested evidence about Levante Bell, it's not possible in this case to say that it's my client who is the shooter and Levante Bell that is not. Even putting aside that it's multiple profile and saying that it's certainly, even if we pretend it's certainly my client's DNA on those items, all that means is that some of his clothing ended up in that alleyway that day.
Why would somebody take off their clothing in an alleyway that day? Well, you know, it's May, he's running around, he's taking off his clothing. That's not normal conduct.
And even if, Your Honor, we take the next step and assume that it's being taken off as part of flight from the police. Nobody sees anybody take off the clothing. We have no idea how long it's actually there, et cetera. But even if we assume that it's somebody running from the police that is dropping clothing, we still don't have enough to infer back from that it was my client and not Levante Bell that committed the shooting. Maybe it was
your client also fled from the police in Wisconsin when he was stopped.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would certainly suggest that flight, months after the fact, without any indication that he knows that he's a suspect or there's a warrant out, is utterly ambiguous as to anything to do with this case. I believe it's October, and this shooting is in the prior May. He's in Dane County, Wisconsin. He gets pulled over by the police. He willingly gives them his ID, and then a few minutes later, I think it's the Wisconsin State Police, or it might be Dane County, ends up drawing rifles and a gun on him. He does lead them on a very brief chase to the next exit, pulls over in a well-lit area, and gives himself up. Now, if we were seeing somebody that was evading the police, he would not be giving off his Illinois ID when being stopped on that freeway. This is something that came up in.
He may not have known that he was
elsewhere.
He may not have known there was a warrant out for him.
There's no indication. And this is why the brief cites the Wilcox case that actually ordered a new trial on that kind of evidence, that without any indication that the defendant knows that they are a suspect, evidence of flight just doesn't create any kind of favorable inference. It should be excluded as prejudicial.
And he was also on a dark road, and he drove until he was in a lighted area, and then he stopped and surrendered to police, yes. Correct? He did what most people would do, especially Black people.
Yeah, this is an area of Dane County, east of Madison. It's consistent with him having panicked once after sitting there at a traffic stop and giving his Illinois ID to the officers. Suddenly he has, I think it's two handguns and a rifle pointed at him.
So why don't you do this, Mr. Yeasing? Walk us through the Neil V. Bigger. Walk us through those particular parameters that we need to consider.
Just to briefly mention the factors, you know, normally we talk about opportunity to view, attention, the prior description, the certainty at the time of the confrontation, and the time delay. I actually want to start with a prior description because it's so remarkable to me that Officer Strigel puts out that testimony that says, we don't write down a description when the Chicago police shoot at somebody. And so we start out with these very generic descriptions, and you know, the most detailed we have is sort of the clothing. It's other than African-American man of average build. There's not much to those early descriptions.
I just want to remind you that you're out of time, but I will allow you to complete your answer to Justice Walker's question.
Yes, Your Honor. And the brief does go through in detail all these things. I point out that the attention is reduced because these officers are in the middle of firing off 8 shots at the Garfield Park. They're all fairly young officers. This is a high stress situation. And beyond that, at least for the 3 officers, it's cross-racial identification. And this court knows the history of that. You can look at Perry, New Hampshire versus New Hampshire, which is a fairly recent U.S. Supreme Court case that acknowledged that as well. And then finally, Your Honor, I'd like to speak to the time delay. If you go back to the original Biggers case, it talks about how weeks or months would seriously weigh against an identification. This identification, the first confrontations happen about 4 weeks after the fact. And while courts have sometimes excused longer delays when more factors weigh in the state's favor, that's the factor does weigh in Mr. Gardner's favor here. And finally, Your Honors, I'd like to point out that the only actual eyewitness to the shooting, if we're going to apply the bigger factors, is the guy who was right there, who is Sharon Winters, and says it's not my client. So fairly applying those bigger factors requires an acquittal of those 2 convictions in this case. Thank you, Your Honors. I'd ask you to reverse my client's convictions.
Thank you very much, counsel. You do have 2 minutes for rebuttal. We'll go to the appellee's counsel. You may begin.
May it please the court. Again, Assistant State's Attorney Amy McGowan for the people. As your honors have noted, when a defendant's challenge is to the sufficiency of the evidence, such challenges are reviewed in a light most favorable to the prosecution. This court does not ask itself whether the evidence proved defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but whether any rational trier of fact could have found so.
Well, how could any rational trier of fact find this man guilty when Mr. Winters says this is the wrong guy? He saw him. He describes somebody different. How can that possibly be? Where the person who saw the actual shooting and was injured seriously says, you got the wrong guy.
Sure. Judge, respectfully, I don't think that was necessarily Sharon Winters' testimony, you got the wrong guy. He, in court, said he did not see the person who shot him. He also, when they were investigating the case, he stated that he did not have an opportunity to view the person, that it was quick, it was within seconds. He stated that he did not get a good look at the offender's face, that it happened too fast, that he only got a quick glance. He told officers that he would not be able to make an identification if he was shown a photo array or a lineup. Now, he was 17 years old when he was shot, and the first time he's trying to identify anyone is more than 4 years later. So after having admitted that he didn't have an opportunity to view, he didn't have a degree of attention, more than 4 years go by, he wasn't able to make an identification. So the his non-identification from a person who consistently said that they could not or would not identify anyone does not make fatal the four positive identifications in this case. And it's not so, only the...
Counsel, let me jump in here. Why did you discount Bell when Bell was actually caught at the scene and had a connection to the gun? He also called his, I believe it was the uncle, and the uncle then falsely reported the gun stolen the next day, which might be some indicia of guilt. So why did you discount Bell and go after Garner when there was, you know, just as much cause pointing to him as the shooter?
The cause pointing to Bell is how the murder weapon got to the scene. We know that the gun was registered to Terrence Cooper. We know that Bell is his nephew, and that Cooper testified that Bell told him he took the gun from his house. We know that Cooper also knew defendant. The video of the actual shooting shows a person in a black t-shirt and bright blue pants commit the shooting. Even in defendant's brief, I mean, now he's talking that it doesn't show anything and it's pixelated, but on page 4 of his brief, he describes the video as showing the actual person, the man in the bright blue pants and the black t-shirt walk up and commit the shooting. When that person runs away in the black t-shirt and bright blue pants, James Shavers identified him. He watched the video in open court and said that's the defendant in the video. He was 15 feet away from him. He identified him there too. The video shows, and James Shavers corroborates, that the shooter was wearing bright blue pants and a black t-shirt. Officers testified no one else was wearing that outfit. Levante Bell was not wearing that outfit. Levante Bell did not commit the shooting. The person in the bright blue pants and the black t-shirt did.
Were the pants ever recovered? Because that seems to be the major determining factor, or major piece of evidence, I should say.
Right, that the black t-shirt with the undershirt and the do-rag were recovered. Defendant, not that I'm aware of, took his pants off when he was running from the police.
Wait, what was the answer to the question then?
No, I'm sorry. The pants were not recovered. As far as I know, defendant kept his pants on. We do have the shirt with his DNA on it and the do-rag with his DNA on it. So as I was saying, the video shows defendant, who was identified as the defendant, as the shooter in this case. We have an unbroken timeline. James Shavers and the three police officers see defendant, again, in the same outfit, running from the shooting with his gun. They all have the same general description. And here it's a very short location we're talking about. They're at 3333 Maple, and the dice game where the shooting happened is 3306 Maple. There's a poster board of the map and evidence. We're talking a half city block. Everyone described the evening as beautiful. It was 8 p.m. Memorial Day weekend. The sun was still up, not nighttime yet. They all testified nothing was obstructing their view. Shavers, as I said, was 15 to 20 feet away from the defendant, and the officers were behind him. They too see the defendant. They're at distances of 50 to 100 feet, but closing in because defendant is running towards them. They describe they have complete head-to-toe views of defendant. The jurors heard these witnesses describe the surprised look on defendant's face when he saw the officers. They heard the witnesses describe how defendant slid to a stop and made a sharp, abrupt, impressive turn down the vacant lot at 30 through 24 Maple. This is where his clothes were found. Defendant makes much of the do-rag that James Shavers observed defendant wearing at the first opportunity, and I believe is shown on the video also. The officers in the alley didn't know the do-rag because they were able to pay attention to his short black hair. They noted that he had a distinctive hairline, a defined skull and cranium. They mentioned his head shape.
We have all that in the briefs, but I want to go back to something Garner's counsel had mentioned as important, and would you say something else, but Rodriguez testified that the report over the radio, which is what counsel said, was that two black males wearing dark clothing. And that's what she saw when she saw Bell and Alexander. Dark clothing was the report over the radio. It morphs as we get to trial, and maybe it is the lighting. I mean, for you to say, well, you look at it, yeah, that he concedes that if you look at it, but then the lighting changes, and lighting can make colors very different in the videos. So we can't believe, you know, necessarily what we see because of the where the sun is and where the camera is and the lighting and so forth. So if the report is dark clothing and a light pants is not dark clothing, so wouldn't that show that maybe Bell was the person?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that's what that shows. You have James Shavers plus three officers who testified they gave the description of blue pants. When Detective Rodriguez...
When did they give the description of blue pants?
They at trial, they testified that was the description.
That's what I just said.
Right. So they, when asked about their earlier descriptions, they all testified that they had previously given descriptions of blue pants.
When, how do we know that? If they didn't write it down. They didn't write that down, right?
No, they did not write any reports for this.
So that's kind of, isn't that kind of odd that the Chicago Police Department doesn't write down descriptions of someone who shoots at the police officers?
I think the officers explained when they're involved in shootings, they're not investigating it and they're not making reports as officers.
They were looking for a suspect. Shooting or not. So if there's somebody who's involved in a shooting that they're involved and there's a shot back, all of a sudden the clothing mean nothing? I mean, I don't get that. Please try to explain it because I'm sure the public would want to know why the police department doesn't want to identify the clothing of a suspect that they're running after. They did say dark clothing.
I wouldn't say that the clothing means nothing. And specifically when Detective Rodriguez was asked, she didn't recall exactly. All she said was, all I can remember is it was dark clothing. She didn't know if it was.
That's what she said over the radio. It came that it was dark clothing. And then she saw these people running.
Right.
With dark clothing.
I apologize.
So
again,
the fact that it's missing from the police report, when police are supposed to be writing everything down, but they have a policy not to write it down in this situation, is makes opens up a large question that the jury may not have been completely aware of.
And I can't understand. I can't say to the Chicago Police Department's policies. I have no answer for that.
That's fine. That's fine if you're not able to address it possible. I don't want to follow up with the direction that Justice Hyman is going here. We know that there were no reports done by those three rookie officers, but someone did an investigation and someone took a report. So the question comes back still to Justice Hyman's question. Well, did someone write anywhere in a report that was taken down after they spoke to the officers, someone who was investigating, detective or otherwise, did they then note anything about the light blue pants?
The reports weren't admitted into evidence, right? And all we have is
They're not going to be admitted, but you would have that information.
I have what's in the record, what's in the appellate record. I don't have the court file. I don't know what was in the police reports.
Okay, so you don't know, and that's fine. Nobody testified to that is what you're saying. And that's fine. If it's not in the record, it's not in the record. I'll move on. If it's not in the record, it's not in the record. But I want to come back to Mr. Yeasting's argument. He's arguing that as far as the sufficiency of the evidence is concerned, what we're dealing with here is that no eyewitness identified Gardner as a shooter and that there's no forensic evidence that links Gardner to the weapon. So if you can just respond to that, because that's kind of where the sufficiency of the evidence takes us. If we can, if what Mr. Yeasting is saying is correct, there's no eyewitness, trial or otherwise, who identified Mr. Gardner as the shooter, and there's no forensic evidence linking Mr. Gardner to a gun or a weapon, respond to that, please.
Yes. What I would say, Your Honor, is that we have an unbroken timeline here. We have a video that shows the actual shooting. We have a witness who was on the scene in front of the Ike Sims building who watched the video and who was on the ground and watched defendant run past him. James Shavers identified defendant as the person in the video who committed the actual shooting. Now, there's three officers behind James Shavers. Behind James Shavers. And when defendant runs towards them, he sees officers. He makes a quick turn down a lot. They meet him at the end of the alley, and he raises their gun and runs away. He gets away from the officers. He's not apprehended on scene. But we do have his clothing. The gun is there. You're correct. There's no forensic evidence linking him to the gun, but there is circumstantial evidence. We know that his friend, Levante Bell, had the gun. Also, what I think is very important and wasn't addressed yet is that his car is just on the other side of the fence, door open and running. It's a car that he's insured to drive, a car that has his dry cleaning receipt, a car that has his phone in it, his own iPhone, as evidenced by multiple selfie pictures taken of himself on that phone. So when you put all of this together in the light most favorable to the state, the jurors had sufficient evidence to find defendant guilty.
Even though Mr. Bell admitted to having fired the weapon that day or shortly before this shooting to his uncle?
Well, I think we have to take Mr. Bell's admission for what it's worth. Even defense counsel, I think, admits there has to be something made up about that story. There isn't a shooting at a liquor store seven blocks away. So either that's made a half hour later, Bell calls his uncle to see if the guns are registered. Another half hour goes
can
by.
Can you tape that over? You froze for a couple of seconds.
Yes, I'm sorry. The shooting happened at 8 o'clock. A half hour goes by before Bell calls his uncle to ask if the gun's registered. That's all we know of the first conversation. Another half hour goes by. It's 9 o'clock now. Now, again, defendant hasn't been apprehended. An hour after the shooting, Bell has this story. We don't know if it's true, and I'm not sure if I was frozen or cut off, but I was saying I think even defendant admits some parts of Bell's story has to be untrue. There couldn't have been a shooting at a liquor store seven blocks away and the shooting here. Some part of it is made up. Bell wasn't there. We have to take Cooper's testimony for what it's worth. We also know that he falsely reported the gun stolen. So, yes, it is tricky with the gun, but we know that it was Cooper's gun. We know Cooper said he gave Bell permission to use it. Cooper knows defendant. Bell knows defendant. And defendant is the person in the video shooting Aaron Faisal.
Well, we know that there was a dark shirt and bright pants in the video.
Correct. And James Shavers and the three witnesses. Now, identification testimony, too, has to be taken in the light most favorable to the state and with the understanding that it is the function of the triers of fact. The jury was responsible for determining the weight to be given to the testimony, to assess the credibility of the witnesses, resolve inconsistencies, and construe reasonable inferences. And they listened to all these witnesses testify. They were instructed as to the figures factors in their jury instructions and in closing arguments. The counsel went through them. They watched each of the witnesses point to defendant and identify him in open court. They listened to how each of the witnesses, just 26 days after the incident, viewed photo arrays. We're told that a subject may or may not be included, but each pointed at defendant's photo and said, that's him. That's the person running with the gun.
But then I haven't had Bell's photo in that array. That's highly suspect Bell was... It's his gun, and the police know it's his gun, right? And he's not in the array?
I can't say he was not in the array. You're correct. But I can't say why he wasn't in the array. If he didn't match defendant's... If he didn't match defendant's description at all, and he was in the array, I mean, I do know that they try to get people similar-looking, similar height build. I can't say why Bell wasn't in the array. But the jurors were all told this. Defense counsel argued... All the evidence points to Bell. The jurors rejected that theory. The jurors also heard Sharon witness testify, and two, they were the triers of fact. They judged his credibility as well. They know that he wasn't cooperative after the fact. They knew that he testified, that he told officers he wouldn't be able to make an identification. And sure enough, he didn't make an identification. He had consistently maintained that he could not or would not identify anyone. But here we have four witnesses who did identify the defendant. And like I said before, unbroken timeline, the video lends credence to their identifications. We have the video, we have the witnesses identifying him as he's running down the street past them into the alley. We have his clothes in the alley that he ran through. We have his car on the other side of the fence. All of the evidence leads to defendant and not to Levante Bell.
There was some evidence leading to Bell. However,
Bell brought the weapon there.
Was there a description of Bell at all?
By whom?
But do we know what Bell's description was? How does it line up to the description that Winters gave?
We don't know. We know Detective Rodriguez said she ran his information through to dispatch, which I believe was a general description, a birth date and driver's license number if she had it, and then was told to release him. Okay. But I don't know anything further about Bell. I do know that he visited defendant a number of times in jail and that he too had addresses in both Chicago and Madison, just like defendant. But other than that, there's no information on Bell in the record.
What about the fact that the police officer's testimony gets more specific at trial than it was at the time closer to these events? And oftentimes I've heard the state say when the defendant's or witnesses' testimony gets who testify for the defendant gets more specific, they criticize that. Why didn't they say that at the beginning? Why did it become more specific with time? How do you respond to that?
My only response to that is I'm not sure. It wasn't brought out at trial what each of these officers said during the initial investigation. What we have are the descriptions they gave on the stand. They weren't asked in detail about what descriptions they gave in the beginning. We do know they gave a general height and weight. I have Ponto here. I think it was Ponto. I'm sorry, I lost my spot. But 5'6" to 5'9", and defendant was 5'6". There was a talk if he was dark or medium complected. And I think even looking through the record on an arrest report, he's noted as dark complected, but on another, his medium complexion. So these discrepancies were for the triers of fact to determine, to resolve. One last thing I wanted to get back to on the witness identification, defendant relies or cited Macklin and relies on Macklin and Slim. And I think Slim outright rejects the challenges that he's making in regards to the any discrepancies. The court in Slim noted that it's very common for witnesses to be off 5 to 6 inches, 50 pounds, or 15 years, that it's not uncommon and it does not destroy their testimony. That, the defendant noted that the witnesses didn't ask or didn't distinguish between defendant's nose, whether it was broad or flat, whether his face was round or oval. And Slim said that witnesses are not expected to distinguish individual features, but a positive ID can be sufficient with only a general description. And it discussed many cases where a witness's failure to note missing teeth, length of hair, facial scars, tattoos, mustaches, etc., did not render the identification vague or uncertain, and they deferred to the finder of facts findings. And here, the jurors were the finder of facts. They resolved any inconsistencies. They determined the weight to be given to the witnesses' testimonies and identifications.
So, but in this case, the eyewitness, she didn't speak to any of the witnesses, did she? To determine whether or not... Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who
Dr. Macklin.
Right, correct. She didn't. And the jury, and I'm sorry, defendant was called witness Macklin as their expert witness, but also relies on a case Macklin. Their expert witness did testify of all the factors that could affect identification, but then testified that she didn't actually interview the witnesses. And to find out that if they affected them, you would have to basically do further investigation. So she didn't really have a solid answer. And the jurors, too, they were able to accept or reject her theories. And based on the verdict in this case, we know what the jurors found and who they found credible.
Okay, you have 1 minute left, counsel.
Thank you. In sum, defendant is on video in his black t-shirt, do-rag, and bright blue pants walking up to and shooting a dice game. Shavers identified him as the person in the video and the person who came running right toward him with a gun 15 feet away. Three officers chased defendant into an alley. After running away, defendant discarded his shirt and his side of the fence. And in the light most favorable to the prosecution, this is sufficient evidence to lead a reasonable trier of fact to find defendant guilty. So for these reasons and those stated in our briefs, the people request that you affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you very much. Attorney Yeasting, you have 2 minutes reserved for rebuttal.
Yes, and briefly, Your Honors. I think it's a serious mischaracterization to say that James Shavers is an occurrence eyewitness in this case to the shooting itself. The only actual eyewitness of all those people there is Mr. Winters. James Shavers is doing what the Thompson case from the Illinois Supreme Court says is lay opinion testimony, saying, well, I saw someone I think is this guy running a little bit later. So based on this cluster of blurry pixels in this video, it must be him. And the fact that Mr. Shavers purports to make an identification on a do-rag in that video when it is utterly impossible to try to tell is the kind of, it's what Cunningham from the Illinois Supreme Court called bad apple testimony. It shows just how much he's willing to exaggerate to say things that he thinks is what the police or prosecutors want to hear in this case. Now, Justice Hyman had asked about Chicago Police Department policy regarding not writing down statements for police-involved shootings, that this is a 2014 police involvement where they fired 8 shots in Garfield Park. I believe it's People versus Horton takes judicial notice of the later 2017 Department of Justice report. And if you want something that is a specific source on that policy, it's been litigated out. And this was the practice at the time, even if it wasn't an official policy. And finally, Your Honors, we have nothing to explain away Levante Bell that's coming from the state. There's nothing out there that can referee as to who the actual shooter was between Mr. Bell, who was stopped running from the shooting and who had his uncle's gun that day, and my client, William Gardner. Without something to referee that difference, we can't make the rational inferences that are necessary to support a conviction. And therefore, I would ask that this court reverse Mr. Gardner's convictions.
Okay, any questions from the panel? Okay. Well, I'd like to thank both counsels for your presentations on today. You were an excellent example of how to make an appellate argument. I'm sure our students who are observing have probably taken quite a few notes and will have something to strive for. And so I thank you for your advocacy on today. It makes our jobs more difficult. So we have taken everything under advisement and will issue our ruling as soon as possible. All right, thank you very much. That concludes these proceedings.
Thank you.